Hello and welcome to the fifth episode of the Hope Illuminated podcast, your source for the stories, science, and strategy of suicide prevention and mental health promotion, where we live, learn, and work. I'm your host, Dr. Sally Spencer-Thomas, and I'm on a life mission to empower communities with solutions that help people overcome isolation and despair and rekindle a passion for living. Each episode, we're joined by international experts who inspire hope and offer real guidance. Welcome to the show. I am so grateful that you are here. Today's show is about how to support someone living with a mental health condition, especially someone you are very, very close to. This can feel overwhelming, scary, frustrating, and lonely, and it also can be some of the most rewarding work that we do in our lifetime. I know in my family, we definitely take our turns. After my brother died by suicide in 2004, my husband was the bedrock of our family. He was super responsive in crisis mode and made sure that the kids got fed and got off to school and the dogs were walked and all of this as I was just a puddle on the floor. And then later, when I had my episode of depression, it was really my father who came in and noticed the changes and really advocated for me to go get some mental health care that helped me get back on my feet. I've also been in the position of having to advocate for a loved one through the very difficult mental health system that we have. And even though I had connections within the system and I had knowledge of the importance of the crisis, it still took me a very long time to find the right people to get this person through the doors of the mental health system. So I know firsthand, not just as a professional, but as someone who has lived through it, both as a patient, as well as an advocate, how challenging it can be and how absolutely critical our care team is. The Mental Health America has put together a kind of five tip sheet on how to be an effective caregiver, and I'm sure our guests today will be sharing with us some of these themes. Number one, it's really important to become educated about brain health, especially around medication and its side effects and the different forms of treatment, really about the buffet of resources that are available in the community and online. Not everything is going to fit for everybody. And so to be aware of what these are and what the benefits and possible negative side effects might be, so that you can be a knowledgeable referral source when your loved one might become stuck or where things might not be working. Number two, to really encourage in a positive way, reaching out or various types of care and treatment. For example, work together to create a wellness recovery action plan is a good thing to do collaboratively with your loved ones so that you're on the same page on what's working and what's not. Give people freedom to take control of their lives. This piece of self-determination is really critical. Having choice and having agency over the direction of one's life really is a critical part in regaining mental health. Number four, they suggest be a friend, really well-verse yourself in the skills of active listening, and ask open-ended questions about what makes things better, what's making things better today, what's actually making things worse, and how can I help? And then the last part they say about being an effective caregiver is about self-care. This is hard work. Sometimes it's super stressful when you're uncertain about the well-being or when things aren't working out as you'd hoped. So it's really important to also surround yourself with a support system and take care of yourself so that you can be the most effective caregiver possible. So with all of that said, without further ado, it is my distinct honor and privilege to welcome my friends and colleagues, Kevin and Margaret Hines, to our show. And I'll give you a brief background about these two amazing brain health, mental health advocate, and suicide prevention rock stars. And then I'll turn it over to them to share a little bit about their story. Kevin Hines, if you haven't heard of him before, which is hardly imaginable, he is a global brain health advocate and storyteller, pretty much like no other. His story is a remarkable testament to the strength of the human spirit and a reminder for all of us to love the life we have. In September 2000, Kevin Hines leapt off the Golden Gate Bridge, a method of suicide that has resulted in death for most of the thousands of people who have made that jump since the bridge was erected in 1937. But Kevin survived. He survived, and in the years since this unimaginable moment of emotional pain, Kevin has become the bridge between suicide attempt survivors and their families, and the many of us trying to do the work of suicide prevention, intervention, and crisis support. He has won multiple awards, really high prestigious awards. In 2016, from the Mental Health America, Kevin was given their highest honor, the Clifford W. Beers Award. He's also received a Lifetime Achievement Award. Lifetime Achievement. He's a very young man. Lifetime Achievement Award by the National Council of Behavioral Health in partnership with Eli Lilly. He's also been awarded by SAMHSA with the Voice Awards and also an achievement winner from the U.S. Veterans Affairs. So many prestigious national and international awards. Has also served alongside Kennedy in congressional hearings on the mental health parity bill. And he's recently released a best-selling memoir entitled Cracked, Not Broken, Surviving and Thriving After a Suicide Attempt. And finally, he's currently producing a documentary entitled Suicide, The Ripple Effect. And we are all anxiously waiting for this premiere. I remember the first time I met Kevin. It was early on in his journey, and he was kind of just getting his wings spread as a professional speaker. And I remember sitting in this audience just in awe of the incredible story that he will share, but also what a powerful, powerful storyteller he was. And I have heard him speak now, oh, I don't know, probably over 50 times easily. And the man still brings me to tears every time I hear him because he's just so heartfelt and so incredibly powerful. No less amazing is his beautiful wife and life partner, Margaret Hines. She is going to be on our podcast today as the main part of our story about her role as a caregiver and personal protector. Margaret also has a long list of incredible accomplishments. She's co-founder of Conquer. Conquer is a global team of dynamic peer leaders and social disruptors that are working to positively disrupt the current landscape of mental health, wellness, and suicide prevention. She's also, along with Kevin, been on the founding board of United Suicide Survivors International with me. So I've gotten a chance to get to know her and her amazing brain of incredible ideas through that work. She comes to behavioral health and wellness with over 10 years of experience in private equity and venture capital, which just brings a whole new world to this conversation. She has a proven track record of building strong partnerships and understands the value of collaboration, which is her main mantra. She is passionate about working with social entrepreneurs within wellness and brain health industry. And she found Conquer as a platform to create a high impact in social change and wellness. Kevin and Margaret, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you, Sally?
Hi, Sally.
Good. Hello, hello. Kevin, let's start with you. I'm sure many of the people listening are somewhat aware of your story, but if you could help those who are not familiar, just to get a little bit of a sense of kind of what brought you into the space of being such an incredible advocate for suicide prevention.
Sure. Well, at 17, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder type 1 with psychotic features, which is a long way to say that my bipolar disorder, as well as the highs and lows of bipolar disorder, the mania and the depression, I experienced severe paranoid delusions and hallucinations, both auditory and visual. And I was dealing with that for 2 years, from 17 to about 19, and I wasn't dealing with it well. I was on occasion binge drinking until blackout on the weekends while on psychotropic medications, which really could have ended me. I was haphazardly following a treatment plan. That's to say I wasn't. I was pretending to. I was telling my family and my doctors that I was working hard in treatment and that I was taking my medications accurately when I wasn't. I was telling them that I was doing better and feeling better and I wasn't. I was telling them that everything was working out, and really, I was falling apart at the seams. When my father would go to work every day, I was living with him, my parents divorced. My father would go to work every day trying to provide for us, and I would be absolutely crumbling inside, believing that people were out to get me, trying to hurt me, trying to kill me all the time. believing that the U.S. Postal Service workers, the white trucks, blue eagles on the side, were really assassins. I mean, I really was having a difficult and terrible time. And when my father would come home at night and say, "Kev, how was your day?" I would just lie. I got to the age of 19, barely dealing with all that, and I, although I had many other symptoms that were just awful, at 19, really the depression became so overwhelming that it turned to regular thoughts of suicide. And Sally, I made my way somehow to the idea of the Golden Gate Bridge, and my belief was that I had to go and die there. But just to be clear, in my situation, Sally, I never wanted to die by suicide. I just absolutely, beyond a shadow of a doubt, believed it was my only option. And I think it's important for a lot of people to recognize that it's not always a want, these suicidal ideations, as much as it is a feeling that you don't have a choice. And that's the difference between someone who says, you know, oh, you decided to take your life. I don't think people decide to take their life like they decide to go get a piece of pepperoni pizza, like they decide to go to the gym, right, like they decide to go to the movies. In my opinion, many a time, it is a compulsion caused by such unwavering mental instability that you feel you have no other option. And so I'm glad to make that point. And yes, it led me to the Golden Gate Bridge on September 25th of the year 2000. And Sally, sadly, I did go over. And I always say in my speeches, that's not the important part of the story. The important part of the story for me is what happened next. At the millisecond of free fall, instant regret for my actions. Instant regret, and the recognition in my mind that I just made the greatest mistake of my life, and I thought it was too late. And in that thought. I was basically saying goodbye. I mean, I was falling 25 stories, thinking, "What have I just done? I don't want to die. God, please save me." You know, I came up from the water 70 feet beneath the water's surface when I went down. My back was broken in several places. I missed severing my spinal cord by 2 millimeters. It was really terrifying. And in that water, all I wanted to do, Sally, all I desperately wanted to do was live. And there were some things that came into play that you know about that absolutely saved my life. Some things that are quite miraculous. Suffice it to say, Sally, I am very, very lucky to be here. And that's an understatement.
Thank you so much, Kevin. You brought up a number of really important points. I just want to underscore this first idea of suicide as a choice. And I know a lot of us have been talking and thinking about this quite a bit. And I love our friend and colleague, David Covington's blog he wrote about this.
Yes,
David. So I'm going to put that in the show notes. He really talks about it's not so much a choice as we understand it in terms of free will. It's more of a succumbing to the overwhelming pain. And he writes beautifully about that. And then your other piece about the instant regret, and I think this is such an area of research that we really need to do a lot more on, is this idea of when you step over that threshold, oh, my God, what have I done? And I think part of the reason why we see, abundance of self-rescue after overdose or cutting or whatever, and people misunderstand that it was just a manipulative thing. No, people actually came to realize what that actually meant, what that behavior actually meant. So thank you for sharing that. Let's transition now to a little bit of how you met Margaret and kind of the early days of your relationship. And then I want to make sure that we hear from Margaret, too, for her insights onto those early experiences.
Of course. And really quick, just that instant regret idea. Often it's the thought of suicide that is separate from the action. And people don't understand that. They think that people are being manipulative. That's just not the case. But anyway, so Margaret, my love, comes into my life. Okay, well, this is Sally, this is my favorite story in the whole world, okay?
I know
so
it is.
you have to know it. Okay, so I'm in my third psych ward stay, and I'm finally getting a bit better, and I'm working really hard to get better. I'm doing all the things I need to do to stabilize my brain in my third involuntary psych ward stay. And And one day this kid, this young kid comes in on a gurney. He's catatonic. He can't move. He can't talk. And I was so saddened by this that I was feeling better at the time. I was in for 2 months. I had a long way to go. And I thought, okay, I'm going to try to help this kid. So here he is sitting down, and they give him his trays of food. And, of course, he's not eating them. He's catatonic. He can't eat anything. And it made me so sad that they would bring him his tray, and an hour later they would take it away. So I sat with this young man, and I would just talk. And I always joke in my presentations that he was a good listener. He was catatonic. that gets a laugh. But the specialty of this kid was that anywhere between 15 and 22 people a day would come to see him. Now, that's unheard of, Sally. You know that. In a psych ward, in the psych wards I've been in, Sally, the numeric majority of people in those psych wards have had no one to come visit them all each of the 7 times, okay? This kid had a plethora. And this family, they would be there through thick and thin, and they had his back no matter what. And in the middle of the psych ward stay, I go to the nurse's station, I go to my case manager, and I said, you know, I'd really like to volunteer for the psych ward. And the first case manager was like, no, you can't do that. That's illegal and unethical. That's not going to happen. And then she went on vacation, and the new case manager was much more lenient. And she was a hippie, and she had salt and pepper hair and a flower around her neck, flowers around her neck, flower in her ear, I mean, the whole thing. And I said, can I do something? Can I productively work for the hospital? She said, sure. You know, that sounds like a lovely idea. So I start to do these odd jobs. Well, one day they give me this job of cleaning out the giveaway clothes closet for when people leave the hospital, which is, you know, you just organize the clothes. So I bin, box, label everything. And I realize all the men's stuff, you know, sort of kind of fits me. So I walk out of there one day with a Ralph Lauren double-breasted polo suit and a 70s yellow flared collar, like a gangster who owned the place. Anyway, the next day I'm wearing like a khaki cargo shorts and a polo pink shirt, and I look like I worked there. And I get a tap on my left shoulder, and I turn around, and there she was. And I looked into her beautiful brown almond eyes, and I said to myself, I'm going to marry her. And I quickly said to myself, well, geez, don't tell her that yet. It's a little early. You know. And she says to me in front of the entire nurse's staff, and the whole psych station, excuse me, do you work here? Completely audible for everyone to hear. And I'm freaking out because I think they're going to rat me out. I'm holding the clipboard to my chest. You know, she thinks it's official. It's got Leonardo the Ninja Turtle on it that I've drawn. And I'm making the afternoon visiting hour announcements, and she walks in, taps me on the shoulder, and I see her, and I just knew. And I said to her, well, as a matter of fact, miss, I'm a volunteer. And they didn't say anything because I had done so much work.
It was true. You were volunteering.
And it was true. I was it was true. So anyway, she says, well, I'm looking for my cousin. His name is, and it's this kid that was having such a hard time with catatonia. He's come out of catatonia, and he's moving around. He's talking now, and I had a part in that. And she says, I'm looking for, do you know where he is? I said, right this way, madam. And I put my hand on the small of her back and her elbow, and I glided her there. You know, it was really silly. And I get her there, and I don't want the kid to see me because he doesn't like me for all the talking I was doing. I mean, he kind of came out of his catatonia just to say, geez, man, you talk too much. you know, and, well, I duck out in the hallway, and I hear her say to him, oh, my gosh, your nursing staff is so nice. And this guy goes, that guy, at the top of his lungs, that guy is a nutball. That guy jumps off bridges. And it was, you know, she goes, oh, my God, they let them run loose around here. And to her credit, she had never been in the psych ward. She didn't know what it was like. And she thought I worked there. And so she comes out. She says, why'd you lie to me? I said, I didn't lie to you. I'm a volunteer. I happen to also be a patient. Anyway, I become friends with the kid. He forgives me for all the talking. I become friends with the family, but really my sole goal is to become friends with Margaret. In the hospital, one day she comes in, and I stop her short at the door, and I said, Margaret, when I get out of here, I'd like to take you to coffee. And she smiles and then looks around at the H-shaped psych ward, and she goes, oh, honey, hell no. Anyway, so
in the way only Margaret can do,
Margaret can, and you know, I got out of the hospital. He got out of the hospital. I became friends with the family. I'm in a halfway home, and I do my 30 days probationary period. But my whole goal is that after that 30 days, when I can go out on the weekends, I'm going to call Margaret, and we're going to go on a date. And we end up having that date, and it's a complete debacle. And I don't know if we have time to go into it, but it was a total mess. And she gave me a second date, and I'm lucky that I got that chance.
I want to hear the date. Just really, it's the one of the best
parts
of the story.
Okay, I'll be succinct. All right, so she makes reservations at her favorite Italian spot, which is apparently an old mob hangout they claim in San Francisco. We go to this tiny table in this tiny restaurant in San Francisco, and the weirdest thing is, Sally, you don't order. They look at you, they judge you, and they order for you, and you better not have allergies. And they get her an eggplant parmesan deal on this tiny table, and they get me. The guy clearly didn't like me. He puts a giant bed of spaghetti, a mountain of marinara sauce, and a huge uncracked lobster atop all of it, an oddly cut lemon wedge, like on purpose, a plate with a votive, a candle, and boiling butter. And I am thinking this is going to be a mess. The first thing I do is take the cracker and I go for the tail. The first thing that happens is a bunch of marinara sauce gets on my only good white shirt. I try to clean it, Sally. There was no way.
No,
so I'm thinking she thinks
off.
I'm a slob, and that's exactly what she thought. Well, I'm telling myself, as I've got this marinara sauce all over my chest, I've got to do something classy now. I've got this self-dialogue going, Kevin, you could do this. Just bring it back. Don't be so clumsy. And I go and I grab the lemon wedge, and my hand starts to shake. I'm looking at her. I'm looking at the lobster, I'm looking at my lemon wedge, and I squeezed, except Sally, I missed my bite, and I squeezed a stream of lemon juice directly into her left eye.
Uh-oh.
It was awful. She's crying, mascara is running down her face, and the old couple next to us is saying, Miss, are you okay? I mean, it's just a mess. And I said, Margaret, I'm so sorry, and I said, Kevin, do something right now. Do something classy right now. And I said, I know, I'll put the butter in the hole in the lobster. I take the same shaky hand, I tip the plate of the butter, and two droplets of butter fly between her chest, through her blouse, on her chest, and they burn her. And she really screamed.
Oh, dear.
The couple next to us goes, Miss, do we need to call someone? I said, you don't need to call anybody. You're going to call the Ghostbusters of dating. Can you leave us alone? I said, Margaret, I'm so, so sorry. And I didn't know what to do, so I freaked out because, I'm a gentleman, Sally. I grab my napkin and I reach over. And this is in the speech where everyone goes, oh, because what I've just done is reach over to the woman I'm on a first date with and rub the butter on her chest. It was a mess,
no.
Sally.
No.
And she looks
no.
down and she goes, what are you doing? And I looked at what I was doing, and I was like, oh, my God, I don't know what I'm doing. And she says the only two words you never want to hear on a first date in the first 10 minutes when you haven't even eaten your food. Check, please.
Oh, ouch,
Sally,
ouch, ouch.
I've already planned my entire life around this woman in my head. I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God, we're not going to get married. We're not going to have the kids. We're not going to have the dog Max we were going to have. It's over, And we get back to the apartment. She's kind of walking in front of me like, I feel like she's trying to get away from me. We get to the apartment. She looks at, oh, I didn't tell you. When I got to the apartment, Sally, before the dinner, I had a giant ski duffel bag of my things. And she looks at me and she says, what is that? And I said, well, it's a funny story. When you leave the halfway home on a Friday and you're out past 9 p.m., past 9 p.m., you can't come home until Monday. She goes, oh, I mean, she screamed, oh, hell no. And at that point, before the dinner, I said, I'll just go lay on this pillow, this bag is a pillow, on those stairs across from your place with a jacket as my blanket because we have to go on this date. Well, then the date becomes a nightmare. We get back. She looks at the bag. She turns around. She says, Kevin, we're going to the roof. And I'm thinking she's going to throw me off or something. We get to the roof. We lay down on these yoga mats, and I'm thinking, what are we going to do, yoga? And she turns to me, and she says, so tell me your story. And then she says, Kevin, if we just sit, lay right here and stare at that moon, ain't nothing else can go wrong. And I thought, oh, my God, I have a chance. And we'll be 10 years married this June.
Woohoo! Congratulations. Congratulations. So, Margaret, let's hear it from your side a little bit about how you came to fall in love with this again.
How I came to fall in love with Kevin?
Yeah, and kind of your experience of the early days.
Well, I there was a lot of education that I needed early on. I just like everybody else who didn't have much exposure to mental illness and or even, loved ones in a psychiatric ward, my experience with psych wards were people in were movies like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. So I'm thinking people in the psych ward should, you know, are usually locked up or they're really volatile, and that's how everybody the patients in the psychiatric wards were, and that's not true. So when my cousin was admitted to the psych ward and we met Kevin and all the other patients there, I realized early on that a lot of what the media perpetuated is incorrect. So as I got to know Kevin, I also realized that, you know, they're just people that have brain health issues, just like if he would have had a broken arm or a kidney that wasn't functioning properly or heart disease. And Kevin is very self-aware and always has been, at least since the very first day I met him. I learned so much from him with regard to not having any shame or not stigmatizing your disease, and also not allowing discrimination to ruin your day or your life or your psyche. I remember one of our first dates, Kevin, we were sitting at a restaurant in San Francisco, and Kevin did not silence his voice when he said, well, you know, when I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and then the folks next to us just started looking at us and started kind of scooting away slightly. And then he proceeds to tell me that, you know, when he jumped, which I was aware of, his jump off the Golden Gate Bridge, but he didn't silence that either. And he said, well, when I jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge, I was going through these delusions. And he's just telling me about his experience with this brain disease. Mm-hmm. And people around us were not happy. They looked kind of startled and shocked, and then it turned into kind of disgust and fear even. And then I realized how much ignorance there was out there. But I learned through this whole process that I cannot, I have to really kind of stand up for this cause. It's a human rights issue. It's a civil rights issue. It's something that we all need to get educated on. So that was kind of the biggest, the most important thing I learned from Kevin early on. And of course, Kevin is one of those people that is one of the most empathetic and sensitive people I've ever met. So of course, how could I not fall in love with him?
Yeah, of course. You bring up an amazing, I fall in love with Kevin, not in the same way you maybe, but he just gives so much light and love to the world. It's hard not to have that really strong attachment to him. You bring up a really good point, and that is kind of the shift in our thinking from stigma, something that the person living with the condition must own and wrestle with, to really putting it out there where it belongs in discrimination and prejudice. A little bit now about that this is, you know, like other health issues, a lifelong thing that Kevin must manage, and how that has evolved over the decades you've been together. How have you worked your partnership so that, you know, he can, you know, change medicine and brain health?
Sally, I'm sorry, you were cutting out a little bit. Can you please repeat that?
Shoot. Okay. What I said is that Kevin's health condition, like many people with severe and chronic health conditions, is a lifelong thing that he's, you know, has to figure out how to manage. And I'm wondering how your partnership has evolved over the decade so that you can best, you know, support him in his recovery and healing.
Sure. So the evolution has really occurred with me more so than with Kevin, to be perfectly honest, which is why I am so lucky. My education really began with regard to brain health and suicide prevention, really began with Kevin. He has been dealing with his brain health issues since he was, you know, 17, at least 17 years old, potentially even before that, but really kind of dealing with it properly and healthily since he was 17, between 17 and the age of 17 and 19, when I met him, he was 23 years old, and he has always been very self-aware. I think for Kevin, it's more of a case of educating everybody else around him, because he does not stigmatize this disease. He really has, since the day I met him, looked at it as if it were just another disease. If he had diabetes, we would have been dealing with it, you know, the same way, openly and honestly, and I would have still been his caregiver at some point, as we got married and continued our relationship. They're just different nuances that we have with dealing with the brain versus the kidney versus the broken arm, because they're different treatments, but they're treatments nonetheless. So a lot of it has actually really had to do with my education. I had to evolve as a caregiver. In the very beginning, Kevin, in 2004 to 2004 to 2007, Kevin was very, he didn't have a lot of peaks, and he didn't have a lot of valleys. He was, for the most part, pretty even keeled. His mental health was, the pills were working fine, his routine was working fine, and he was able to kind of manage between being too high and too low. Between 2007 and 2009, we noticed that the medication started to kind of, the medication efficacy started to kind of wane, and was not, the medicines were not working quite as well. And so, again, this was part of my education, where I really just paid close attention to his mood swings. I asked a lot of questions, and I monitored him, so I was with him a lot. But Kevin is also very, very in touch with his emotions, so if I'm not asking the question, he'll tell me anyway. So I noticed that he started to spend more time in bed and didn't really want to get up and go for a run like he previously did. And when I say this, he started to spend more time in bed, I would say this happened maybe 2 days out of the week, 6 to 8 days out of the month, whereas between 2004 and 2007, he was not doing any of it. He was up at 5 in the morning, went for a 10-mile run every single day. Things started to kind of go downhill with regard to his mental health, and I started to notice that. And a lot of it was just me being really conscientious of this. I started to read more about it, and I and Kevin also educated me early on, thankfully. So the one thing we do have is brutal, brutal honesty between us. So I said, I remember one morning I said to him, something's wrong with you, and I can tell you're not as well as you have been. And being really honest and self-aware, he said, I think I'm going through some sort of depression. Well, this continued to happen more often between 2007 and 2009. It wasn't consistent. It was definitely inconsistent, but it was throughout those 2 to 3 years where I noticed there were more instances of this. And as the years progressed, they happened more often. So we realized that his medication was something was going on, because he started to keep his routine more consistent. So he was going to bed at the same time, getting up at the same time, and that always helped. Working out every day, he would pick it up. But then when the depression kicked in, as it was more often, he wasn't really wanting to go to the gym. So we were evaluating a lot of these things that he was doing or not doing, and he started doing everything, and the only thing that seemed to potentially be the issue was the medication. So as a caregiver, I would go every once in a while when he wanted me to, or when I thought it was necessary, go to his psychiatric appointments with him, share with the doctor what he couldn't necessarily articulate all the time, and then also advocate on his behalf with the doctor. So I would ask questions like, are those brain medications that you're prescribing him, what are the side effects? Are they actually counteracting some of the asthma medicines that he's taking? So I learned early on to really make sure that his doctors and his dentists, all of them, were actually speaking to each other. And I not just encouraged that, I enforced that, I demanded that because of the very strong medications he was taking for his brain. I also got educated on the medications that he was taking. And then I started keeping logs of when he was taking them and what he was eating, his workout regimen, and his sleep regimen. In 2011, Kevin needed a med change, a significant med change, and he went through significant suicidality. That was really hard for me to watch because I didn't, I had never dealt with this before, and it was bad. It was really scary for me. I didn't know. I didn't really know. My background is in finance. It's not in mental health or suicide prevention. So again, being really lucky that Kevin is so self-aware, he ended up going to the hospital and admitting himself. I obviously went with him, but he self-admitted, and he was in this particular hospital for 2 months. Almost 3 months at this particular hospital. Throughout that 2 to 3 months that he was at this hospital, I went in every single day, visited him every day, and there were some days when I actually begged the doctor, and he allowed me to stay all day. I would take time off work, and I just wanted him to feel really supported, and when he would say he missed me, I would spend more time with him because I wanted him to feel secure, and I wanted to give him all the possibilities and tools to be happy. So I would bring him his favorite cereals, and I would bring him his Snickers bars, and I would bring him salads and healthy foods and Mexican food and not so healthy foods, but everything that he liked. And I would bring him his soft pajamas. And so he felt really loved. But only thing that really that helped him, we found out, was that the medications he was on needed to be changed. The doctors needed to titrate up and titrate down on the medicines, which is what the previous doctors were not doing. And then he went through 26 rounds of ECT, electroconvulsive therapy.
Wow.
So throughout this whole process, I learned to ask questions, and they mostly were the right questions, and sometimes they were just questions that may seem like dumb questions, but for somebody that doesn't have a background in medicine, they were important questions, all of them. And also, I learned early on that I needed to advocate for him and for me, and that if I needed to ask the doctors the tough questions or switch doctors because we weren't happy with the way they were treating him or the way they were responding or their communication, then we needed to switch doctors because that comfort level was really important, and the access to the doctors was really important to both of us. So these are the things that we were not going to compromise on. So that was kind of my experience with Kevin, and now I feel a lot more I feel adequately equipped, a lot more so than I had previously, to deal with whatever is going to come, ahead of both of us with regard to his brain health.
So, Margaret, again, you're powerful of really being this advocate for Kevin, and I know from watching the two of you interact over the better part of a couple of years here at least, that it's a testament to the transparency and brutal honesty, as you called it, that the two of you have with each other, that builds up a level of trust that allows this to happen, that allows this kind of caregiving and care receiving to happen in the way that it does. Kevin, when you were sharing your story earlier, you talked about your father and his attempts to reach out with you when you were in your teen years and really struggling, and you weren't really in a place to receive that help. And this is often what I hear from family members that are really struggling with their caregiving, is that they're not quite sure how to reach through. They're getting a lot of rebuffing. Can you talk a little bit about that and kind of what was going on in your mind when you were in that space?
Yeah, well, when you're first diagnosed with a mental illness, what I aptly title a brain disease, and you're living with such immeasurable brain pain, and you don't know which way's up or down. You don't know what this is, why you got it, you know, the old why me thing, and you don't know what it means for the rest of your life, and you think, Sally, you think that I'm going to be sick for the rest of my life. I'm never going to have a good life. I'm never going to have a good quality of life, and this is my forever. And that's the mistake we make, Sally, is that we don't recognize, and frankly, nobody told me. No doctor in the beginning told me, Kevin, you can live well with this disease utilizing a very strict routine and regimen of building mental stability and being brain well. Nobody told me that in the beginning, so I was floundering. I was drinking. I was taking medications one day and not the next. I was taking them 7 days and not the next, or taking them while binge drinking. I was devastated by the notion that I was this flawed. I felt insecure about every action, and I felt that no one could love someone who was this unwell. I felt that my family truly hated me and was just pretending to care for me. Distorted realities resided over my brain every day. And in those distorted realities, my brain rationalized that I was the greatest burden to all around me. Now, Sally, all I would have to do was ask somebody who loved me if that was true and take their reaction upon face value as fact, because they would have told me otherwise. And my father desperately tried to be there for his son. He tried there to help me in every way he could, but he would say these things like, Kevin, I don't know what to do. I'm a banker, not a psychologist. We would butt heads every day because my disease caused me to fight with that man. The person who loves me the most in the entire world, the man who loves me the most in the entire world, I would fight with on a day-to-day basis, because I was not well. And he tried everything he could to keep me safe. And even on the day of my attempt, Sally, my father was in my room early in the morning saying, Kevin, why don't you come to work with me today? I don't know what it is, Kevin. I feel like you need to be with me today. And when I tell that to people in my speeches, their immediate reaction is to say, well, why don't you just tell them? But what they don't understand until I tell them, Sally, is that all the while my father is saying, be with me today, I'm hearing a man's voice in my head, not that of anybody I recognize, an auditory hallucination saying, be quiet, Kevin. Shut up, Kevin. Kevin, you have to die. And that won the day, really, you know, and ultimately led me to go over that rail. And I think it's interesting, you know, when we look at these things, to recognize that when someone is in that state of mind and they are potentially suicidal and you have that inclination, it is pertinent you ask that direct question. Now, you're not always going to get an honest answer, but oftentimes, Sally, in my understanding and in my actions of intervening in people in suicidal crisis, when you ask that question, in my estimation, my understanding, and my experience, I have heard people return with tears in their eyes and say, how did you know? How did you know? Because you've just effectively given them permission to tell their pain. But we are so bred and born to shy away from that question because of fear. Fear that if we say that question, oh, we'll put the thought in their mind. It's a typical old myth from the old days. And that myth is just that, a myth. Because if you asked a person who wasn't suicidal, Sally, are you suicidal? Sally, I've done that, and they look at you sideways, and they go, can you just, like, get away from me, because that's ridiculous. I'm just having a bad day. But when you ask someone who is in such epic brain pain that question, there is a glimmer of light that shines between the darkness, and you can see their pain.
Right.
And when you can see their pain, Sally, you can help them.
Thank you. Very much. It's absolutely true. It's sometimes they also feel like they're shouting from the mountaintops, I need help, I need help, and nobody's actually paying attention. And so when you ask that question, they feel that connection. Can you fast forward and tell just a little bit about what your relationship with your father is like today?
Oh, my gosh. You know, we had a rough patch there for a while, Sally. We had a rough go at it for a long time. And then my dad did a few things. He went to the NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness, family-to-family class in San Francisco, and he got educated on depression, and that changed his mindset. My father went from a man who would say things like, Kevin, why are you always crying? And I would say, Dad, I'm just so sensitive. He would say, well, get unsensitive. You know, he was an old-school fella, old-school Sunset San Francisco Irishman, and this man was tough as nails, and he's been through a lot. In any event, he went from that guy, the guy who didn't understand, the guy who didn't empathize, the guy who didn't emote, to the guy who read the book Loving Someone with Bipolar Disorder by Julie A. Fast, to the guy who went to the family-to-family classes with NAMI, to the guy that would become the best man at our wedding. And he was the only option. And that would never have happened if that transformation hadn't occurred over time. And my father went from adult-parent relationship to almost equal relationship, like adult-adult relationship with me. And we are, in a sense, my dad and I are colleagues. We go and we speak together. My father was my greatest caregiver before I met Margaret, and now they are together my two greatest caregivers. My father and I are in essence best friends, and it's a special relationship. It's one that is probably one of the greatest relationships in my life, and I never thought I'd get to say that, Sally. Which I'm very happy.
It's a beautiful arc to the story that I want the other families that are currently in that space of struggle to hear, because it is possible to get to the other side. And I will put in the show notes, in addition to you know, your website and the link to the trailer to your documentary and your book and David Covington's blog on the ideas of suicide not being a true choice. I'll put in there the NAMI family to family link. And is there somewhere we can find the Loving with Someone with Bipolar Disorder? Is that something I can get a hold of also?
Yeah, that's on Amazon. If you just go, Loving Someone with Bipolar Disorder, Julie A. Fast, and it's in its third edition. And just one more thing, Sally. My dad and I read the book Bipolar for Dummies together.
I
have it right here. I have edition one and edition three right here. I'm in edition three. I did an article for edition three. So that was something that really helped, because it was just, it's such layman's terms to describe bipolar disorder, and it's so much fun to read. And that's by Candida Fink and Joe Kranach. And it's just something that is so easily helpful for anybody. And they're now I think they're making dummies books for every mental illness.
That's great. That's great. It makes it kind of an almost enjoyable way to go through it, through their very resource.
If you do it with someone who loves you, it's really helpful.
All right. Well, I'm going to also put into the show notes some research around the science of social support, especially within the family system. I want to turn now back to Margaret about what are the takeaways? What do you want to tell our listeners about strategies, tips, how they might avoid pitfalls in their work in supporting someone they love who's living with a mental health condition, a brain health condition, suicidal thoughts? What are like the top three or four things that you would say, please do this or think about this?
One is, the first one is take care of yourself first. I think if you're not well, then you're not functioning on all cylinders. You can't really be a caregiver to the best of your potential. I think you have to really put yourself first. It's like the same analogy when, you know, you're on the plane and the flight attendant tells you to put your mask on first, then you can help your child and put their mask on. It's very similar to that. That's something that I always tell other caregivers. The other thing is advocate for your loved ones with regard to their doctors, psychiatrists, therapists, because sometimes when your loved one is going through a brain health issue, they are not able to really articulate properly or advocate for themselves or even communicate. So it's always best that you are 100% and you're able to advocate for them. Ask questions. I learned that a closed mouth does not get fed. And if you don't ask questions, even if they sound like dumb questions, if you have the question, you're paying them, whether it's through your insurance or out of pocket. They work for you. So you should be able to ask them questions, challenge them, because you, at the end of the day, you have to feel like you're doing everything you possibly can to give care to your loved ones. I think the other thing I would say is get educated on the disease that your loved one has, and don't be afraid to be really honest with them. Ask them questions. I think that brutal honesty is really, really important, because as you get educated about their disease, you're going to have questions, and you're going to need to learn just like you would about any other topic. So if you have to sit there and ask them, hey, are you suicidal, or what does it feel like, you know, when you're having a flashback, or talk me through this depression, ask them those questions. Don't be afraid. Communicate a lot and get educated.
Fabulous. Okay, let me do a quick summary of all the amazing things we've been chatting about today. Then I'm going to ask you each for your final thoughts, and then we'll just do a little bit of a closing, and we'll be done. So, Kevin, we started off with your incredibly poignant story of a very, very sad and tragic downward spiral. We listened to you share your father's attempt to reach out to you and how unlovable you felt in that moment that you could not receive his care, and how really it was part of your illness that you had some of these delusions and different distorted thinkings that prevented you from being able to hear him reaching out in the way that he did, and the many things that he tried. And in fact, just as a side note on that, I have actually heard several people that I've spoken with and interviewed and so forth who are suicide attempt survivors talk about the power of the auditory hallucination right towards the end, right before the attempt. And these are people who have diagnoses of things like bipolar condition or schizophrenia, where that might be an expected part of the illness. But it's also the case I've learned of people who do not have those kinds of thought disorders. And so I'm very interested, because they talked about how absolutely powerful and overwhelming those hallucinations were. So thank you for sharing that part of it. We also talked about the idea of suicide as a choice, or is it really a choice? And I think more and more of us are leaning towards this space of understanding it as succumbing to overwhelming pain rather than this active free will. You talked about the instant regret after the action. I also understand that to be quite a common experience for people, as they understand the very great difference between the thoughts, which are kind of a coping mechanism to escape the psychological pain, and the behavior, which is the end, and kind of coming to that realization that maybe there's more in me to try. We talked, Margaret, we talked about stigma and discrimination and prejudice and the human rights issues. And I think that's really what CONCOR and United Suicide Survivors International is really about. I'm just so honored to be your partner in this army on the war against discrimination and these issues, so that people can have an easier access to regaining their lives. And then the tips for caregivers, I'm going to summarize and kind of weave in your stories about how you did this with Kevin. You said it's really important to be an advocate. A closed mouth does not get fed. And I love the image of you going with Kevin to the doctor, asking all these questions about medication, really advocating for switching when it wasn't working, and being able to stand up to a doctor and say, hey, this isn't going right. I love your, willing to switch providers to get the right care for your loved one. And just going with him in general and being with him and bringing things of comfort and familiarity, you know, whether it's a Snickers bar or his jammies or whatever, that's really what a partnership is all about. Number two, it actually was your number one, was self-care, for caregivers to really be in a space of strength to provide this kind of care for someone. Really means that you need to sleep well, and you maybe need to get your own kind of counseling or support network to get you through, and eating well and doing all of those things so that you can be consistently there. And if you're struggling with living with your own mental health condition, that needs to be a priority in the partnership. You talked about educating yourself on brain health, educating yourself on the resources. And your story, unlike many that I've heard, is really about this brutal honesty, transparency, and communication. I really believe that's how you guys make this work and has made it work for so long, is that you have this real huge sense of trust with one another. I've seen you call limits on each other. I've seen you say, hey, this isn't working with me. And you're able to kind of re-rudder and redirect when that happens and keep it going. So thank you so much for being a model for so many families who are trying to figure this out right now. Closing thoughts.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Let's start with you, Kevin. What are some of your closing thoughts?
You know, I think it's important to note that maybe not everybody is going to find this kind of epic, beautiful love, and that's okay. You know, that's not the point of life. But you can find stories of hope within your own that allow you to continue to go, to keep going. And one of the things that keeps me going, besides Margaret, when I'm in my darkest of thoughts and in the most pain I'm having, and Sally, I think it's important to recognize, I have these suicidal thoughts on a regular basis. I deal with the symptoms of this disease every single day, no matter when people think I'm just, you know, perfectly fine because I go to a speech. It's still within me. It's still something I battle and I live with every day. Live rather than battle. I live with it every day. And that's okay. It's okay not to be okay. It's not okay not to have someone to back you up. And here's the deal. The reason I get to thrive with my mental illness is because I always, always turn to Margaret, my father, my friends. And when I'm in doubt and when I'm in trouble, I say, I need help. I need help now. And they work with me to get that help until I'm safe. And I think it's important for families to know that just because someone you love says they are thinking of suicide, it's not always the case that you have to go into DEFCON 4 mode and put them inside a hospital. Sometimes the individual just needs to say, I need help, and you need to say, I'm here. And you sit with them. And you push aside all responsibilities and you be with them until they're safe, unless it's an acute situation and they're in dire danger.
Right. Thank you, Kevin. And where can people find information about your movie and your book and your speaking and all the great things that you're doing? Is there one place that they can go to find all that?
Yes. You can go to, right now you can go to kevinhinesstory.com. There's a link to suicide, therippleeffect.com there. You can find it all in one fell swoop, and something we're really excited about is 17mproductions.com, because that is our video hub, our video channel, where we produce original video content. We call it All Mental Health all the time. It is hopeful, inspiring, intellectually stimulating messages from people all over the world who are helping people with their stories find hope and healing and live in recovery. 17mproductions.com.
Thank you. And if you want to just get that dose of inspiration every day, you can also follow Kevin on Facebook. Margaret, closing thoughts from you.
I think my advice to caregivers would be to keep an open mind. Understand that challenges are just a part of life. But if you can put your wellness ahead of everything else, you're going to get through a lot. You're going to be able to take care of your loved one. Don't give up.
Good.
That's pretty much
Don't
it.
Give
yeah.
up. That's great. That's great. Well, as usual, I have felt so inspired by being with you two. And I think that the lessons that you're sharing here will help so many families. So thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. I appreciate all the listeners who've tuned in to get this information to help each other. You can find all of Kevin's stuff on Kevin Hines Story, on Amazon, on YouTube. Please follow him. He's absolutely brilliant and inspiring. And Margaret's now carving out her own keynoting career. So we will get more information from her, but also visit the Conquer site. All of this will be in the show notes. I'm having a little bit of a contest right now as we're getting this podcast launched. So if you go to my website, sallyspencerthomas.com, leave a rating and review for this on iTunes, and also subscribe to my newsletter, I will be pulling a winner for $100 Amazon gift card. So do sign up for those things. More episodes are also on the website there. So In closing, as I like to say, please join me. Open your hearts, challenge your thinking, and take action to save lives. Together, we can restore dignity and sustain a passion for living. Thank you.